listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 31st installment of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR, and today we're going to dive in deep into Leon Trotsky. That's where we'll start. Who knows where we'll end up?
Thank you, Dan. Good to be with you.
The same. Yep, thank you.
We are doing that. And we're really looking at Trotsky in the 30s, and particularly 1938-39. We're skipping from what we were talking about, which was the 1917, his role in the 1917 October Revolution. But I'm skipping now to illuminate some of his ideas at the time that war was going to break out. So, a bit of a background, just because we did this months ago. So I'm going to summarize some bit. So in the 1930s, war in Europe was becoming a certainty. It would come sooner or later. Everybody knew that. The victory of fascism in Spain made it sooner than later. Fascist Italy and Nazi Germany had tested their weapons in the civil war in Spain on the side of Franco, and had got the better of the Republican forces by 1939. Now, the Soviet Union had seen the threat of fascism to sovereign nations, but especially to the Soviet Union, as we know, very early in the 20s,
right,
before fascism was even born. But so it had seen the threat coming even before the Civil War broke out in Spain. So in 1935, delegates of the communist parties of the world gathered in Moscow to put together a strategic plan on what would be the best way to defeat fascism. Now, as we know, this was the meeting of the Sixth Comintern. Right. It was decided at that time that the communist parties in each country where they operated legally would drop the politics of class confrontation and class conflict against bourgeois parties that had been the program of the Fifth Comintern of 1928. Right. Now, this had been a period when capitalism had seemed weak and ready for overthrow. So, but with fascism, the capitalist countries had decided to go for broke and stamp out the threat of socialism. So the sixth, so the sixth Comintern decided to put the class struggle on the back burner. The overthrow of capitalism had to wait, while military fascism threatened the survival of whole nations. So the Sixth Comintern therefore adopted a program of the United or Popular Front. And this was to be an alliance with all anti-fascist parties, liberal, social democrat, anarchist, etc. Now, this cooperation by revolutionary parties with bourgeois and non-revolutionary parties was simply an emergency measure. And in no way a permanent alliance with the bourgeoisie. However, Trotsky, who formed and headed the Fourth International in exile, in opposition to Lenin's Third International, I think that was 1919, which had become the platform of the Bolshevik Party in the Soviet Union since 1919, Trotsky called the Popular Front the betrayal of the internationalist task of the October Revolution of 1917 to carry out a world revolution. Now, this is his idea of permanent revolution, which we'll get to later on, a whole section on that. Now, to conclude the preamble, from 1935 to his death in 1940, Trotskyism took a position against alliances by communists with the bourgeoisie democracy in function of anti-fascism. They took a position of alliances in function of anti-fascism. Now, so this kind of alliance, they said, amounted to an alliance with imperialism. To his thinking, fascism and imperialism were two different things, separate from each other. And the greater evil was imperialism. Now, I think this was the first error in Trotsky's thinking in this regard, to separate fascism from imperialism.
Right.
How could he? We have the example. In Italy and in Germany, fascism acted as the vanguard army of imperialism.
Right.
Italy considered Libya its living space, the place where Italy could stretch out to relieve unemployment, seize resources, obtain markets, and enslave the native population for cheap labor. Ditto for Somalia and Ethiopia. I mean, fascism is imperialist. Hitler saw Russia, as we well know, and the East as his Lebensraum, Germany's Lebensraum, right, its own living space. Right. And Trotsky could not know of Hitler's plans for Russia by 1938-39, which eventually, in a year before the invasion of Russia, became Plan Ost, which is the extermination of the Slav people to a certain percentage. I didn't put down, I don't have the notes, certain percentage, by hunger, by extermination, some enslaved, some sent to Germany as servants, etc., and labor, which happened during the war. So, now, I think I may be concluding this portion. To say that fascism is one thing and imperialism is another, is theoretically unsound and politically divisive. The two are twins. And so I see this making this division, fascism is one thing, you know, it's oppression of police and it's oppression, and imperialism is conquest, extermination of other nations, the nation state, and this is another big issue. You know, fascism is suppression of the people, police state, etc. Imperialism is just the evil intent of metropolitan capitalism to expand. In other words, yes, that is true, but that is not the whole truth. Lenin had a different interpretation of imperialism, mm-hmm. which involved monopoly capitalism, financial things. It was a system, not just an action. And we'll have to talk about that when we talk about permanent revolution. So, right. So he divided. So now, what is interesting is that we see this in the United States now. We see a division between fascism, as they perceive it, and imperialism. In time of rampant American imperialism, we see the left, whatever, you know, the left in the United States, that is the liberals, they call themselves left, and the radical left, if there is such a thing, we see the left in the United States ignore Hillary's imperialism in order to fight what they call Trump's fascism.
That's right. Yeah, you nailed that. That's exactly right.
I wanted to get to this, which took me, you know, it's been bothering me. So they ignore the, so you know why you go to South Carolina, whatever, you know, you fight fascism there, because imperialism is totally different.
Right.
Imperialism is what everybody does. It's just, you know.
Yep. And so, you know, not for, so let's
yeah,
look
go
at
ahead
who,
now.
Let's look at who goes there. So, you know, a lot of the folks are, let's say, college students, recent college graduates. They can afford to travel, and they can afford the time to go to Carolina at the drop of a hat as part of political organizing effort. And they can afford to be mobilized. Okay, this is, you know, these are very different conditions here that we're talking about than people that are mobilized in within their own communities because they can't go anywhere else. So we're talking already about a particular class niche,
class.
If nothing else, okay? And
a particular what? I'm sorry.
Like a class, like a slice of a class.
Of a particular class.
That's right. So it has a class character. It's petty bourgeois. That's
right.
The class character.
And so...
The very conditions that allow these folks to, you know, to organize, the very people organizing them, as a matter of fact, are, this all rests on imperialism. The wealth that supports their discretionary income, you know, the trickle that they get out of it, is what imperialism is stealing from around the world. It's the political equivalent or the national equivalent of white privilege. Writ large, only within the system of imperialism instead of within the system of white supremacy, as if there were, they could be distinguished, but you know, to the extent you can distinguish them and must distinguish them, you're looking at the global system, imperialism, providing the material wherewithal for these folks to be protesting, and they do not protest imperialism. And further, within the larger struggle that's going on right now, among imperialists, there are the imperialists who are hegemons. They want they call it the United States, but they want the military power that's, you know, in the whose title is in the name of the United States, that belongs to them, to be the prevalent sole power globally. The other faction is looking at multilateralism, in other words, multiple centers of power distributed among the elites of multiple nation states, Russia, China, South Korea, Japan, European Union, whatever. And Trump represents the latter, and the entire rest of the political establishment represents the former. That's been policy, not just since PNAC articulated it in their document, but, you know, since really since Ronald Reagan and earlier.
Oh, yes.
And that's what the great cry coming out of, you know, what they call the deep state, but coming out of the media, coming out from across the country, that cry is over a change in policy that's just been threatened to occur, hasn't even occurred yet, that we might pursue a policy that acknowledges the rights of other actors on the global stage and engages them within that construct. That is the big offense of Trump to the establishment. And that's those are the two forces that are struggling over the question of imperialism right now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question about this. It seems, or I've written about it, Trump has delegated military decision over actions, about actions over Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan. What was that, a compromise, the old establishment pulling plausible deniability? What was it?
Well, okay, first of all, I'm going to answer the question, but I don't mean to imply that I actually know, okay? These are things us are unknowable, of course. But this is my reading of events, you know, given what I do know, whatever that value that might have. First of all, you have to look at, there has been a very active battle going on, even with casualties, between the Pentagon and Langley, you know, between the Pentagon and the CIA, in essence.
Yeah.
On the ground in Syria, you had, you know, basically the military backing this group of fighters in Syria, the CIA backing that group of fighters in Syria, engagement of one against the other with casualties.
Yep.
So, you know, there is, to say competition, I think, leaves out the essential military character of the conflict between the two, that they were in effect already in a state of war. Now, Trump comes into power, this is my reading, Trump comes into power with the antipathy...
Within this conflict.
Within this conflict, and as the target of a conflict by the CIA and the intel agencies. They clearly, you know, people have their opinion about this. If you look honestly at the material around Russiagate, quote unquote, and particularly around the FISA application, you know, for the one that's been exposed for Trump guy, it's clear that this is an excuse for them to wiretap the campaign. They were actors. They were dropping, you know, information into the narrative all the way through. They were the CIA, whoever else, the intel agencies were very actively engaged in trying to get Hillary Clinton elected president or appointed or whatever. And as a matter of fact, in my opinion, the public relations campaign that we're looking at is also coming from there. This is exactly what they do everywhere else in the world as they engineer a coup or an invasion or both or whatever. So, and this happens here within a year of Obama authorizing those intelligence agencies to do exactly that, which had been forbidden since the National Security Act in 1946 or 47 or whatever it was, when they created the CIA. So, you know, this whole game is afoot. Trump comes into it. Intel is against him. There's only one other player that's got guns involved. It's the military. So you go to them and you say, okay, look, my enemy, your enemy. You guys are in charge of foreign policy. Deal with them first. That's what I see going now. I don't know if that's what's going on, but I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, well, I thought that was going on from the beginning. That is, and I put it in these terms, that there is a war within the ruling class and that there are interests behind it. But you're identifying the CIA and the Pentagon as being at loggerheads, I agree with. Now, remember that even that Michael Flynn,
Michael Flynn,
In 2015, I quoted in the essay I have in Counterpunch, what was really, really, really targeting the CIA. He said, he said many things, but, there's a quotation. Can you read it aloud? It's significant. It's 2015, which attacks the CIA for its drone program.
Yep. The drone campaign right now is really only about killing. When you hear the phrase capture, kill, capture is actually a misnomer. In the drone strategy that we have, capture is a lowercase c. We don't capture people anymore. Our entire Middle East policy seems to be based on firing drones. That's what this administration decided to do in its counterterrorism campaign. They're enamored by the ability of special operations and the CIA to find a guy in the middle of the desert in some S-word little village and drop a bomb on his head and kill him. That's what Flynn commented on back in... in 2015. That's right, before his appointment in 2017, in 2015.
Before he was involved with Trump and his appointment for 3 weeks in 2018.
Right.
Now, clearly there is the voice of the Pentagon.
That's right, I gotcha. Well, of course, though. The CIA, the CIA doesn't need the Pentagon and doesn't need the military if they've got drones. All you need is a guy in a closet somewhere with a joystick and a monitor. They got plenty of those.
Yeah, and then Flynn continues, or was it some other, in my article, some other general who was ejected by the Obama administration. I said, this is creating great problems for the United States, problems of reputation, all kinds of blowback possibilities, because this is the most illegal war you can possibly imagine. This war, this drone war, violates sovereign states.
That's right.
It doesn't take in the pursuit of the war on terror in the clause of the 60 words that gives the president the authority to do whatever he likes, essentially, right, if it means so-called protecting the lives of the United States. If there is a terrorist in Thailand, the drone will penetrate. That's the only excuse they have. If there is a terrorist in Thailand, you can just violate sovereignty and bomb somebody in Thailand.
Right.
Some S village in Thailand.
Right.
So it is clear from what Flynn said that the policy of the CIA and Obama's policy in Syria was military in the completely wrong sense. And right. I also add that this conflict between the CIA and the Pentagon dates back to Vietnam.
Yeah, we know that it does, actually, for sure. And you know, it's hard to, you know, there's an old saying that I'm not going to use that deals with the uncertain parentage and et cetera. When you're in a room full of such folks, it's hard to know who the good guy and who the bad guy is, because the dispute between the Pentagon and Langley back in the Vietnam War, for example, one of the disputes was the Pentagon was like, look, we got all these nuclear weapons, let's just bomb the hell out of them. And the Pentagon saying, Langley saying, we don't know about that.
Yes.
Now, this is after Dulles was gone, because he was, in favor of a whole lot of stuff that,
he wanted to give France 3 nuclear bombs.
Yep, that's right, to use.
To use Indochina, which became, and they said no.
That's right. France said, we ain't that crazy. So, as crazy as France was, they weren't that crazy, okay? We had Waterloo, Napoleon, all kinds of funny stuff, a lot of guillotine things, but we ain't dropping 3 nuclear bombs on Indochina, okay? So that's too crazy for us.
Yeah, so I'm glad we agree on this point of that there is a tremendous struggle between the establishment, and I would call the establishment the Council on Foreign Relations, the State Department, the media associated with it, that they're just servants, but the whole establishment versus the Pentagon. You can call the Pentagon crazy, but it's supposed to know how to do war.
Right.
That's and the thing that the CIA did, in essence, was to lose Syria.
Yeah.
I mean, the methods and the strategy that Obama chose, he's a complete failure. His foreign policy is a failure.
But see, here's the problem for them. Just in terms, they have a legal problem, which is why which is why the CIA... Right, exactly. You know, the problem that they have is that there is no legal route to a military involvement. In other words, basically, to a U.S. invasion of Syria without the Security Council authorizing it. And when Russia and China showed that no more Libyas and vetoed the first resolutions, then rather than drop the matter, they then shifted to, you know, CIA and you know, ops, quote unquote. And so what we saw was what we now, to be clear, we saw that in Libya as well, because the political problem that Bush faced still took place in Iraq. We had, you know, remember millions of people out a month before he started the war. I mean, it was well understood that it was going to happen. But, you know, February 15th, 2003, okay, huge turnout in the snow up here in the Northeast. You know,
all over the world, 3 million in Rome.
Yeah, around the world.
3 million in Milan, Indonesia, Malaysia.
Around the world. And now Obama, no less, comes into office supposedly as, you know, an opponent of that war, and also, you know, making speeches about nuclear disarmament, and, you know, he's being treated even by Fidel Castro and Gaddafi and others as of the third world and all that. It's kind of harsh for him to turn around and do the same thing. So what they did was they had the CIA organize all the irregulars on the ground. They had basically Al-Qaeda as the ground troops, and got authority to do with the air. Just the Pentagon got the Air Force. That's all. You guys take out their air defenses, take out their strongholds here and there, and you know, level everything there. And our Langley's Al Qaeda dudes will take care of the rest.
In other words, we are in charge here, and you are our subordinate, and you just use the tools that we tell you to use.
Right.
We don't go with your policy. You don't draft anything.
That's right. So, you know, Trump comes into power
and that happened in
that situation. And now, see, Trump's disagreement, it did happen in Vietnam, their disagreement with Trump now that takes place over policy. In other words, the policy is multilateralism against hegemony, essentially. You know, the CIA, those guys are the instruments of hegemony, in essence. You know, the military, the threat of the military, and also the use of the military has been an enforcer of hegemony, but the operation really runs through CIA and such. And so, you know, suddenly the heresy that Trump speaks and the reality that's presenting on the ground, whether you start with the creation of ALBA or the creation of the African Union or the SCO or CELAC or BRICS or whatever, the whole world is moving towards this multilateral model on the ground. And it's, you know, the U.S. policy is so ill-fitted to what's going on. This is presenting, and Trump rides in on that. And the CIA is the base of reaction because they've been the manager of hegemony.
Yeah. The only question I have, definitely the CIA has landed, the Phoenix has landed fully over this whole, particularly the Obama administration. I mean, it was just handed over. The whole hegemonic plan was, execution was handed to the CIA. And they failed.
That's right.
It doesn't work. But my question about Trump is, and it's a question of imperialism. Does he want to pull the United States back from imperialism or not? And the second question is, can U.S. capitalism survive without imperialism?
Well,
is Trump being naive in saying or thinking or whatever that this is a multipolar war and world and we have to adjust to it? Does he really say that? And if he says it, when is he going to be executed?
Yeah, or when is he going to be executed, which is maybe on the agendas. Yeah. And we have to stop here.
No,
we mentioned Trump.
I mean?
Yes,
I'm
we do,
sure
but we're out of time.
Trump is an anti-imperialist. That's what I want to know.
Understood. I understand that. We got to stop now because we're out of time. But we'll pick up here. But maybe we'll go back to Trotsky next week because we kind of left him in the dust. And Luciana, thank you very much. I appreciate it. This has been very enjoyable.
Thank you so much, Don. Have fun. Bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. For two decades after the collapse of the USSR, going west seemed the most natural option for several former Soviet republics, encouraged, though not guaranteed, by the EU itself, and making Russia invariably unnerved. But now that the EU wants to put the brakes on its own expansion, what does it leave the countries in between? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Franco Frattini, former foreign minister of Italy and currently the OSCE special representative on the Transnistrian peace settlement. Mr. Frattini, good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time. The frozen conflict in Transnistria, it's one of the most protracted post-Soviet conflicts. People of Moldova have been divided for over 25 years. Why do you think the Italian chairmanship of the OSCE decided to prioritize it to an extent of putting you in charge of the settlement process?
Well, I think the Italian OSCE presidency has put some important priorities. Among those priorities, there is situation in Transnistria and the possibility to get some concrete results. Because we are convinced, given the goodwill shown by both Transnistrians and Moldovans, there are some fields, some points where it would be possible to get tangible results. I give you just some examples. We are quite close to agree on how to make neutral status car license plates to guarantee the owners of the vehicles that are in Transnistria to freely circulate in the open space of Romania or European Union, maybe, which is not possible today.
And I'm sure that's going to be very important for people who live on the ground and who have been excluded from the economic processes in the region.
But correct.
I'm sure you would agree with me that despite being a very small territory, which is Transnistria, it is also an intersection of major interests of several big players like Russia, the European Union, the United States, Ukraine. Do you think all those interests are now compatible enough to make a path forward possible?
Having some pre-consultations immediately after my appointment, I noted a common goodwill to get results and to succeed. I consulted with the special representative of Russia, Ukraine, the American ambassador, Mrs. Kalnan, who is in Chisinau, and all those people that I've consulted, including the deputy prime minister of Moldova and Mr. Ignatiev from Transnistria, all those people said it is possible to get results, despite the crisis of Ukraine, including the ambassador of Ukraine, the special representative, who said to me, I'm quite optimistic. I was not surprised, but happy to listen to those people.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a few practical matters that you're currently working on at the vehicle number plates that you mentioned
telecommunications
before, recognition of diplomas. There are a few practical issues that can immediately improve the quality of life
daily
for the people.
Life.
But how far can you go in addressing those practical concerns without tackling the most divisive issue, which is sovereignty and independence?
Well, we have to pave the way. We have some good example that I have in mind. My political constituency used to be South Tyrol. It's an Italian province which enjoys, under an international treaty, the Gasperi-Gruber, advanced autonomy. This kind of the advanced autonomy could be an example to look at. I'm aware, I'm not naive, that this problem will be not solved overnight. But if we reestablish mutual trust, for example, if Transnistrians accept the restitution of the farms to the Moldovan farmers in 3 months' time, it will be a very important gesture. If Moldovans would accept to make free circulation for commercial trucks from Transnistria to the rest of the West, that would be another important gesture. We have to pave the way. So far, there has been mutual mistrust. We have to overcome such a situation.
But if I may put a counter argument to that, I know that you often bring the example of Italian provinces as a potential model. You have another province of Alto Adige, if I'm pronouncing.
This is South Tyrol, exactly what I mentioned, South Tyrol.
But which is populated by predominantly
German-speaking people.
Exactly, but in order for that model to be accepted as a viable alternative, what needs to happen is for the government in Moldova, as well as, for example, the government in Ukraine, to recognize that the Russian-speaking minority is not some Trojan horse that is trying to be a conduit for, you know, the politics of another state, but that, you know, those people live there, that they are their own citizens, and they need to be granted certain rights. Do you think both Moldova and to some extent Ukraine have arrived there, that they actually claim those citizens of those breakaway regions as their own?
It's too early to say. It's too early. I prefer to move with the bottom-up working method. We have to create proper conditions to make it possible that Ukrainians and Moldovans, for example, recognize this kind of status of people living in Tiraspol and in the rest of Transnistria. But of course, the result of the status will come later, after some, I would say, trust-building measures have been implemented. Mm-hmm. This is my working myth.
Now, Moldova itself is facing a constitutional crisis with the president and the parliament being in active confrontation, partially because of the different views on how to develop relationship with Russia. So Russia is, again, a major factor here. Do you think a Moldovan consensus, an internal Moldovan consensus, is possible on the issue of Transnistria when they are so divided on everything else?
Well, no doubt, we have a president of Moldova which is pro-agreement. We have a prime minister and a government and a coalition in Moldova which is going through electoral campaign time. As I said many times, this is the only potential obstacle I see to politicize Transnistrian negotiation for domestic problems.
But it has been politicized for decades, hasn't
it? But I saw a very interesting opinion polls in Moldova. Only 11% of Moldovans are interested to the Transnistrian issue. If this is true, I will be in Moldova and in Tiraspol in beginning of March. I don't know if this corresponds to the real feeling of the population, but if yes, it could be my warning to the leadership of Moldova. Please be aware, don't politicize. This is the only potential obstacle.
Now, many Moldovan media describe you as a personal friend of Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and you yourself are on record saying that you have extensive contacts here in
Russia.
It is
not a secret.
Yes. Is that an asset or a liability in trying to mediate this conflict?
For sure is an asset. Sergei Lavrov knows me. He knows me as an honest broker, as an honest person. I will never give up my profound conviction, but I will try always to cooperate. And no doubts, Russia is one of the key players if you want to succeed in the Transnistrian case. I will be meeting, of course. I had a consultation by phone with the SRSR from Russia and from Ukraine, with the American ambassador Scanlon. I will have with Mr. Ignatiev, all I had with Ignatiev. So all people that I had to consult,
but
I did.
I don't want to be too confrontational, but I think in the current European environment and Western environment, being on even balance towards Russia is not always accepted well. Do you understand that even if you are trying to be balanced, that may work against you?
I criticize heavily European foreign policy for being unbalanced vis-à-vis Russian Federation. I'm free to do. I accepted the role of special representative for the good of OSCE and for the good of the Italian presidency. Not for money, not for everything. So I can be free to criticize European
foreign
policy.
But don't you think that is going to undermine your efforts to bring peace to that
because
part of the world?
No, because I will be fully transparent. Once I will have the different points of view, I will put the points of view on the table publicly and transparently. Everyone will be able to evaluate.
Now, some Moldovan politicians and their friends in the West, for example, U.S. Senator John McCain, have long called for the withdrawal of Russian peacekeepers from Transnistria. And back in 1999, at an OSCE summit, Russia pledged to do that, but never follow through. How big of an issue is this right now?
Well, it's simply not realistic now. Talking about the Russian military presence would be not realistic unless we create a comprehensive package, including other points like the status of prisoners, how to treat those people that are imprisoned, or the recognition, the mutual recognition of banking systems. All those people should stay together. I prefer to start from practical and tangible issues that are on the ground. Next step will be to address the bigger issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, not many people in Europe know where Transnistria is, but yeah. I think it is a potentially dangerous flashpoint because it hosts one of the largest and one of the oldest weapons depots in the former Soviet Union. And part of the duty of the Russian peacekeepers there is to guard that weapons depot. I wonder if you see that as a bilateral or as a national issue between the two sides, or is it something that should concern Europe as a whole, including the organization that you represent? Because I would assume there is a security issue there as well.
Well, it is a security issue. It is a comprehensive. This is why I'm very happy that OSCE is prioritizing Transnistria and asking me to try to negotiate and to make progress, because it's not an issue that can be solved only bilaterally. I think the authorities in Moldova are aware about that. The first reaction of the Deputy Prime Minister, she is in charge of the dossier, in talking with me by phone, was very positive about that.
Mm-hmm. So are you actually saying that they, despite calling on the Russian peacekeepers to leave, also want them to stay to perform that function of guarding?
They are not naive people. They understand that we have to solve the crisis, to solve the frozen conflict, by addressing one by one the existing issues that are on the table. The past, the outcoming presidency of OSCE, the Austrian presidency, left on the table a package of 8 points. My duty is to try to implement all those 8 points.
Well, Mr. Frattini, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Franco Frattini, former foreign minister of Italy and the OSCE representative for the Transnistrian peace settlement process. Mr. Frattini, just before the break, you mentioned that before taking on this role, you were quite critical of the Eastern Partnership Program. And this was a special EU outreach program for former Soviet states that incidentally excluded Russia. I heard you say that it was essentially making false promises to those countries without making any certain commitments. Is that still your view, or have you become more neutral since taking this position?
No, I said so when I was foreign minister in 2009 during the summit where in Poland there was the launching of that political European initiative. I was, dear colleagues, be careful. We cannot create false illusions. We cannot give the impression that we have created a shortcut to become very quickly members of EU or members of NATO. This would be a mistake. Unfortunately, I was in the minority. I'm staying in that minority position. This is still my opinion because we got no results in cooperation with Russian Federation in a moment of world crisis where Russia is badly needed to address terrorism, stabilization in Middle East, in Libya, and so on and so forth. And we got no results with those countries. Ukraine is in a pre-collapse situation or crisis. We have to help Ukraine, but if we don't provide them enough money, like we did promise and we did not keep our promise, how is possible? They are in a pre-electoral time. And the same applies to Georgia, for example. Slightly different the situation of Azerbaijan, because President Aliyev refused to accept the biggest mistake made by Europe, the alternative. Either you stay with us or you are against. In my view, it's not incompatible to be friend of Russia and to cooperate with the European Union.
I think many in Russia believe that that arrangement was a little bit exploitive because those countries were encouraged to develop political affiliation with Europe while also getting a lot of economic support from Russia in the form of subsidies. Well, they did. Ukraine was enjoying subsidized gas for quite some time. I think Moldova was also drawing certain benefits from Russia. Do you think it was set up this way intentionally, or this is just an honest arrangement on the part of the EU? Because you said that the EU is not going to give Ukraine money.
I think political decision taken in 2009 was at the origin an honest decision. Then there was, it was reverted into a political exploitation of anti-Russian tendencies. This happened in 2010, in 2011, and of course at the origin of the crisis. The moment of the renewal of the EU-Ukraine agreement was the origin of the explosion, of escalation of the crisis, exactly because some countries, for historical reasons, some European countries, are obsessed about the role of Russian Federation. I can understand, but I cannot agree, frankly speaking. But I can give you the example of a country that I know very well, Serbia. I'm a personal friend of President of Serbia, Mr. Vucic. He was, in some cases, pushed to accept exactly the same alternative. Are you candidate for European accession and, as a consequence, you close and you stop your historical friendship with Russia? Rightly and wisely, President Vucic said no. And in that moment, European Union stopped its pressure over President Vucic.
Well, unfortunately, the same didn't happen in Ukraine. And as we all remember, during the Maidan rallies, the main slogan was Ukraine is Europe, which meant that Russia is not Europe.
But in that occasion, unprecedentedly, you saw one of the highest American State Department officially rushing to the square and distributing.
Well, there were many European figures there too, many European officials.
Did not happen in Serbia.
But what I want to ask you about is, why do you think this juxtaposition of Russia and Europe as two absolute alternatives have become so stark these days? Because we in Russia do not feel themselves to be outside of Europe. We believe that we are a European country.
Because
too.
The wrong opinion of some European member states is the only they have to contain. The old and traditional Cold War policy of containment vis-a-vis Russia, which is in a changing world of today completely obsolete and completely wrong. As I said, we should have more engagement with Russia on terrorism, on stabilization of the Middle East, not less. So, but this is the heritage of the past. I repeat, I can understand, but I cannot agree.
Now, what is done is done. Ukraine is now, I think, is kind of in the state of limbo because it's not going to become the member of the European Union in any foreseeable future. That is being plainly stated.
Nor NATO. Even worse.
But it also cut many of its economic ties with Russia. And it, I think, created the situation when recovering those ties is pretty much politically impossible at this point of time. Whose responsibility it is at this point of time to help Ukraine get firmly back on its...
Both feet? Russia and Europe. There should be a wise decision to integrate Minsk agreement by including a chapter of political cooperation and, first of all, economic cooperation. Let's improve the situation of small and economic enterprises. Let's promote on the territory local creation of jobs and growth.
Can you get the Ukrainians agree to that right now?
They are in a pre-collapse situation. They will have to agree anyway. If Russia and EU apart, all the political disputes will put at the center of the common policy, like creating a local business, small and medium enterprises. Again, a bottom-up approach.
But I think one of the reasons for this situation is that these people, for a long time, they were led to believe that they have their future in Europe. Now, all of a sudden, they understand that the future is not there, but they already closed their door to Russia. And I think we are seeing that happening in Moldova with the president trying to reach out to Russia, not so much politically, but economically. And even those measures encounter significant resistance. Do you believe, in practical terms, that Russia and the EU and all those countries in between can somehow learn to live together without trying to dominate one another?
If I think about Europe, I think Europe has a strong interest to help Ukraine and Russia the same. I cannot imagine Russia losing interest and running the risk to have a failed state at its borders. So it is a common interest because probably the bigger mistake has been made by us, by the West. But the consequences, the impact, are on both Russia and Europe. This is why I would like very much such kind of practical bottom-up agreement on promoting local development in Ukraine. And Russia can be easily interested on that.
Now, we currently have an Italian in charge of the European foreign policy. I'm talking about Federica Mogherini. And I know that you've been quite critical of her. You are on record saying that the EU doesn't have a foreign policy, which I personally disagree on. I think the EU policy of sanctions vis-a-vis Russia is very, very consistent. It's perhaps the only example of consistent foreign policy that the EU has at this point. How long do you think it will last?
Well, until we will have enough states strong enough to say, first of all, we need a political discussion before any kind of decision or renewal of sanction. That happens every 6 months. Next time it will be in June. I strongly hope there will be a new government in Italy strong enough to say in June, first in April at the level of foreign ministers, and then in June we should have a political discussion. I'm sure Italy, Greece, Hungary, and Spain maybe would be a blocking minority strong enough to veto any kind of renewal or sanction. I'm free to say so because I have no governmental responsibility, but this is, I'm convinced about it.
A few years ago, the former Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi suggested in a conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin that perhaps Russia could make the first step in lifting some of those sanctions. And when you think about it, it's an interesting proposition because I guess Moscow could lift sanctions against friendlier countries and leave them in place for some of its harshest critics. But then certainly it would face accusations of trying to sow divisions within the EU. Do you think that's a good idea in principle?
The idea of Prime Minister Renzi was a good one. Unfortunately, has been not followed by a practical and concrete decision from President of Russia, because probably he felt the atmosphere for such a decision with zero gain was premature. This would have been a zero gain decision from Russian side.
But you mean President Putin should have responded to it by relaxing sanctions against all, or simply, let's say, against Italy, which has been friendlier towards Russia
than the others? I would prefer very much against all, in order to mitigate such as alibi from other states. You are promoting your friends and you are putting obstacles to those that are not your friends. But as a minimal standard, as at least relax a lifting or reducing sanction with a number of countries. That would be today also a good idea. But provided that on European side there is a response, there is a recipient number of countries ready to correspond such as an issue.
Wouldn't that strengthen the accusations within the EU that Russia is indeed trying to divide the EU?
There would be any way. But we are divided. This is why I don't agree with you. I confirm we don't have an European foreign policy. We voted simply because we were, as Italy, not strong enough to put a veto. When I was requested to put Russia out of G8 from my friend Condi Rice, I said, Italy is vetoing such a proposal. And nothing happened, because we were a strong government in that moment.
Well, Russia is out of G8 anyway.
Now, because there is not longer our government. And the government that said, okay, let's go out, was not as strong as we were.
Now, and if I may ask you very quickly, I know that you were considered for the post of NATO Secretary General in October 2014. I don't know if it's your Russian ties that cost you that job, but how do you see Russia and NATO navigating their relationship post-Ukraine, post-Trump, as well as post-Libya? Because I think what happened in Libya was a major factor in Russian decision-making.
I was one of those that were present at the signature of Pratica di Mare agreement in 2002, where President Bush and President Putin shaked hands and said NATO-Russia will cooperate, and we gave birth to the NATO-Russia Council. NATO-Russia Council still exists, and maybe you know, they meet. The state of play of the cooperation is practically close to zero. There has been an escalation. There should be a de-escalation and to revitalize NATO-Russia.
Do you also think that Russia has to make the first step, or do you think it should come from the other side?
Russia could make a proposal similar to the one that Russia made when Russia proposed coordination on military action in Syria to the President of the United States. In that occasion, America said yes to the coordination, and then we moved from coordination to cooperation, and Daesh was defeated. Maybe Russians should put to NATO a proposal on counter-terrorism global strategy. That should be one of the priorities. When President Trump says NATO is obsolete, he's quite right.
Well, Mr. Fortuny, I have lots and lots of more questions, but unfortunately we have to leave it there. Really appreciate your being with us. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again. Same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.